Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 4th of May 2012 here in Japan. It is still the 3rd of May 2012 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Roger G. Charles, a retired Lieutenant Colonel of the U.S. Marine Corps and an award-winning investigative journalist who has worked with a wide variety of media outlets, including Newsweek, Vanity Fair, ABC, CBS, the BBC. It goes on and on. In 1996 and 1997, he was a consultant on the Oklahoma City bombing for ABC's 2020, and he is the co-author of a brand new book called Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters, available from HarperCollins imprint William Morrow. Roger Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, James.
All right. Well, first, why don't you describe the book for people out there who haven't yet seen it and a little bit about what it contains?
Well, the book's the result of 15 and a half, a little over that, over 15 and a half years of research. I started on the story in late July of 1996, about 14, 15 months after the bombing, and have stayed with it on and off, sometimes intensively, almost exclusively, and other times I've had other projects. But over the years, a fella who probably did more to keep the story alive than anyone, John D. Cash, J.D. Cash of McCurtain County Daily Gazette in Atabel, Oklahoma. He and I teamed up and we agreed to work and write a book together. And unfortunately, in May of 2007, he died suddenly and prematurely. I shouldn't say real suddenly. He was sick for a few weeks and died, but we thought he was going to recover. And so I was stuck with all this research and documentation and kind of wondering what I was going to do next when I had a meeting with Andrew Gumbel, a British journalist living and working in California. And after several hours of discussing the story, we agreed to explore the possibility of writing a book. We proceeded to make that more definite. And in the summer of 2009, we got a book contract, and the book that's out, as you just read the title, is a product of that collaboration. We have some, I think, major new revelations. We confirm some things that people had suspected, and I would say that the readers will be able to draw their own conclusions, but they'll come away, I believe, satisfied that we've made a compelling case that the investigation conducted by the FBI under the direction of the Department of Justice into the Oklahoma City bombing was truncated, at best flawed, as all human endeavors are, but it was also corrupted, and I believe the pattern clearly shows that the corruption was due to directions from Washington, D.C. at the highest levels to keep the investigators in the field away from certain leads, certain compromising information they did not want disclosed as to the government's prior awareness of a threat to Oklahoma City. And notice I'm not saying specifically to the Murrow Building and also the others who were involved in the bombing conspiracy beyond Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier, have gone uninvestigated and consequently unprosecuted for their roles in this terrible crime.
Well, then let's step back for a moment and take a look at the overall picture that this book paints about what happened on April 19th, 1995 at the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. And let's talk about the way that this differs from the official account of what happened that day.
Well, we have several things. The government has claimed that they had absolutely no prior warning, and yet we start off with the interesting little episode where two Air Force bomb squad guys, and these are very special Air Force bomb squad guys that we know were cleared to work for presidential security, VIP security, and so on. They were ordered from Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico to Oklahoma City on arriving on Monday the 17th of April, 2 days before the bombing. Their orders were to go to a motel and wait there until contacted by the FBI. I had become aware of this information in 1997, developed some confirming information, but the key was that in the summer of 2001, two journalists, one independent freelance journalist in Phoenix, Arizona, and the other producer for 60 Minutes 2, the Wednesday program, had separate conversations with one of the two individuals on this bomb squad team, and that's related in the first pages in the book. He admitted he was there when asked in separate conversations by both journalists why he was there. He responded, as we cite in our end note in the book, "You'll have to ask the FBI." So why would two Air Force bomb squad guys be sent from New Mexico to Oklahoma City 2 days before the bombing, ordered to wait until contacted by the FBI? And when asked, this one individual on two separate occasions gave the same answer as to why he was there: "You'll have to ask the FBI." And of course, the FBI will not discuss it. So that's just one indicator of the, you know, there are others. We get into the phone call to Walter Reed Army Research Institute, where somebody calls either the Friday before the bombing or the Monday before the bombing. I personally spoke to these people, and they relate that they were told to expect a phone call from somebody in Pentagon congressional liaison, and the Pentagon liaison would be interested in getting information about how do you treat victims of blast overpressure bombs. In other words, one of the things was that this office was a research office that basically did research on lab animals. They were not a treatment center. So one of the people I spoke to was an Army veterinarian, a captain, and she was just befuddled by the phone call. They never did get the phone call, but they were told to expect it. I confirmed that with two other people in the office, that they had received this phone call telling them to expect this inquiry about how do you treat blast overpressure victims. As I said, they did not get the phone call. After the bombing took place on Wednesday the 19th, whenever the Oklahoma City bombing was mentioned, the people in the office would either whistle or hum the theme song of the old Rod Sterling program, Twilight Zone. And so somebody in an official capacity called this office and told them to expect a call. And, oh, by the way, the call to the office said that the governor's office of the state of Oklahoma was also interested in the information or was involved in the request. So that's why it was a congressional liaison office at the Pentagon telling them that they would be getting a call. So there are other episodes. One we write about where a guy named Chevy Kehoe in Spokane, Washington, goes into this office at this trailer park / motel that he's staying at 45 minutes before the bombing, asks the proprietor to turn on the TV to CNN, says there's something going to happen. And then when the bombing is shown, immediately after the bombing takes place and the first pictures are being shown on CNN of the bombing, he said it's about time or something to that effect. So there are other things too, the lack of ATF special agents in the building in their office that day. Every one of them, every single one of them was absent. The ATF tried to cook up a story supported by the Department of Justice prosecution team that the senior ATF officer had actually been in an elevator that fell during the explosion and somehow survived an elevator that free fell 5 or 6 floors, along with a DEA agent. I think we convincingly show that that just did not happen, that was a story made up to explain the still unexplained absence of all these ATF officials from their offices on that morning.
I'm interested. I do have a copy of the book here. I must confess I'm only a short way into the book. I haven't managed to read the entire thing yet. But I'm interested to know how you cover the April 18th, 1995 phone call that the FBI received, warning them of an attack in Oklahoma City that was revealed in some documents that were obtained under a Freedom of Information Act request last year that relate to an April 2005 interview with Nichols, in which he talked about this and how the FBI attempted to get him to plead to having made the call himself in return for certain favors that they could do in terms of getting his sentence commuted.
Well, that's just another brick in what I call the wall that we try to build, showing that there was some sort of prior awareness on the part of the government that the government should have been able to prevent the bombing, and that among other factors that created to their failure was this bureaucratic fighting among the federal law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies, just like you saw on 9/11, where the CIA and the FBI, in the case of 9/11, refused to either share information or did not act properly on information that was shared. So there's a lot of that. The FBI has gone to, and again, the FBI is doing this under the direction of the Department of Justice. I want to be very clear about that. This is not the FBI's initiative to do these things. This is under the direction of the senior-most people in the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. And so, but the FBI has followed their orders and has tried pretty much successfully to squelch any kind of information which would question their version of the case, that it's a solved case, that they've identified and prosecuted, convicted, tried everybody involved, McVeigh, Nichols, and allowed Fortier to cop a plea. And I think we make a strong case, and I hope the readers will be convinced by our case that there were other people involved who were never investigated and should have been. They at least had some association with McVeigh. I believe some of them were actually involved. But that's a direction and a path the FBI did not take.
Well, let's talk about Terry Nichols and his involvement in the case, and of course, what he has come to say in recent years about the case.
Well, we were able to have about 90,000 words of correspondence with Terry Nichols, the first time he has communicated with anyone in the media. He's given some first-time information, such as a very detailed description of building the bomb with Tim McVeigh at Gary Lake State Park in Kansas on Tuesday, the 18th of April, the day before the bombing. He has described also how Tim McVeigh threatened Nichols' family with serious violence if he did not assist McVeigh. Terry also describes how he expected the bombing to take place sometime either around Thanksgiving of 1994 or Christmas or New Year's of 1994 and New Year's Eve of 94. And as a result of that expectation, he left the country and went to the Philippines and did not return until mid-January of 1995. And that's an answer. I'm not sure it's the final answer. It's to be proven yet, but I've always puzzled why McVeigh and Nichols, when they had gathered all the components for building the bomb by the end of October of 1994, why they sat on that collection of components, bomb components, until April of 1995. It doesn't make sense. I mean, if you're going to collect the components for a bomb, the longer you sit on them, the more likelihood that you'll be discovered and you won't be successful in whatever your plan is. So Terry Nichols' description of this expectation from McVeigh himself that the bombing was going to be on one of those holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or New Year's Eve of 1994, answers a question to me that I've had about why they collected all the bomb components and did nothing with them for about 6 months. Is it the truth? I don't know, but at least it's a logical and plausible explanation when you look at all the facts that we do know.
Well, let's concentrate on the bombing itself for a moment. And in the book, in Chapter 2, you talk about Stanley Brown, who was a Vietnam War vet. He was a major in the Oklahoma National Guard, a senior member of the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Office bomb squad, who also felt that there had been a pair of explosions, two explosions, that he thought, given based on a meticulous chronology that you note that he made about the events of that day. Tell us more about the blast itself and some of the eyewitness accounts.
Well, that's one of the dueling experts or dueling witnesses, maybe. There are a number of people besides Major Brown that were in the building. He was not in the building, but there were a number of people who were in the building, Murrow Building, when the explosions took place. And they distinctly recalled two separate explosions with enough time between the two that they got under their desk, got out of their chair. When the first one took place, they got out of their chairs and took shelter under their desk for protection. And then the second explosion, the big one. And this is not just one or two people. There are a number of people that have related this very same experience. Then you have the geophysics professor at one of the local universities who had a seismograph, and he shows two distinct spikes, meaning two different shocks on the seismograph, leading him to conclude, initially concluded, there were two explosions. There were a lot of pressures back and forth, experts, and the end result was this fella retracted his claim that there were two explosions and said, well, there was one explosion, but he never explained the two different spikes that I know of. So it's still an open issue. And of course, that a lot of people, some people, a sizable number of people that question the government's case, believe that there were explosives attached to the columns inside the Murrow Building. I've not investigated that in depth. It's one of quite a number of issues or leads that I've left alone because I've been more focused on the connections to Elohim City, the neo-Nazi compound in East Oklahoma, and the involvement of the Aryan Republican Army, also known as the Midwest Bank Robbers, and their connections to McVeigh and the central role, I believe, of a German operative named Andreas Strassmeier, who lived at Elohim City at that time.
Well, before we get on to that, let's just concentrate for a moment on the story of retired Air Force General Benton K. Pardon, who you mentioned on page 53 of the book, who wrote a report to Congress asserting that there had been additional explosives inside the building that could account, that would be the only way to account for the damage done to the building. And you write, quote, General Pardon made some elementary mistakes, including an overestimation of the strength of the concrete pillars and a failure to appreciate the power of gravity to pull down part of the building once key support columns had been weakened. But these flaws in Pardon's findings did not stop a number of paranoid anti-government activists from accepting this and further alleging that the government itself had brought down the building for political reasons too far removed from reality to be worth dissecting here. And given that the majority, I imagine, of my audience will probably believe that there was government involvement in the blast itself, perhaps you could talk a little bit about your discussions with Benton Pardon about his findings and what he has to say about this.
Well, at the time, I was in Oklahoma City, 96, 97, for quite a bit of time over several trips. I actually met with General Pardon and got to know him well. I did not choose to get into the dueling experts, blast overpressure, pounds per square inch. The issue for me was that one of the columns that was closer to the bomb detonation point survived basically undamaged, while columns further away from it and almost in a direct line were destroyed. Now, I had a general engineering degree from the Naval Academy. I'm not a certified engineer, but I've had enough physics and thermodynamics and strength of materials to know that that's just inexplicable. And nobody, including the government in their studies, have explained how that column survived. So the issue of the explosives on columns, I don't pretend to have the final answer on it. I think it's an unresolved issue. It's an issue that has not been looked at, I think, by a completely independent body of experts whose deliberations would be totally transparent. I think that's the only way you're going to resolve that issue.
Tell us about Andreas Strassmeyer and Elohim City.
Andreas Strassmeyer is cited in a footnote where a now retired senior official of the CIA told me that this official had been looking at a document after the bombing, the CIA document, which cited Strassmeyer and described him as a German operative whose information was being shared with the FBI. I believe there is other evidence that just overwhelmingly supports that individual's comment that Strassmeyer was protected. He was over here as part of an effort to destroy or disrupt at least the bonds between American neo-Nazis and the German neo-Nazis. And you have to remember, James, at the time this took place, the early and mid-1990s, neo-Nazism in Germany was seen by the Chancellor, Gerhard Schroeder, he said this in 1998, as the principal threat to the economic and social stability of Germany. Louis Freeh, the new director of the FBI, installed in September of 1993, made his first overseas trip to Germany in December of 1993. And as a result of that meeting, and this is all in public media reports of this trip, Freeh announced at a joint press conference in Bonn, Germany, with his German counterpart, that the problem of U.S. support, U.S. neo-Nazi support, the German neo-Nazi movement, would become a priority for the FBI, and that as an indication of Freeh's personal commitment to it, he was assigning the task to make an effective program to disrupt, if not destroy, this relationship to Larry Potts, his trusted subordinate, his most trusted subordinate. So obviously you have some very high-level officials in December of 1993, both German and American, saying that we're going to start this program and we are going to sever the ties as much as we can between the American neo-Nazis and their German counterparts. The problem for the Germans was very simple. They have laws that you could not publish or print Nazi literature, but that doesn't apply in the United States. So the United States neo-Nazis were printing this stuff and shipping it overland to countries around Germany, where it would then be surreptitiously taken into Germany. And so the German laws were just basically being, you know, overwhelmed by the American support, and the German government was frantic to get some control of this.
Tell us about the Southern Poverty Law Center and their involvement at Elohim City.
Well, we have a number of documents, and as we say in our introduction, that we have unparalleled and unique access to Terry Nichols' case record. And in there are a number of documents which cite the Southern Poverty Law Center is having informants who are reporting to the FBI about the whole neo-Nazi movement. And there's another document which was not in that group. In fact, it was in a totally different set of 300,000 pages of FBI documents that I had access to. And this is a January 4, 1996 teletype from the director of the FBI, Louis Free, to certain field agents, field offices, including Mobile, Alabama, and the ones involved in the Oklahoma City investigation, in which he refers to an informant of the Southern Poverty Law Center who was at Elohim City and picked up some information. And Free relates some of the information. It's documents fairly heavily redacted, but it's clear from that conversation, from that document, and in Morris D's own book published in 1996, he talks about how he knew as soon as the bombing took place in Oklahoma City that it was a domestic terrorist attack, and it was done by neo-Nazis, because he had warned Janet Reno, I believe it was in October of 1994, about the increasing threat, the increasing violent nature of the rhetoric, and that there was just a lot of what they call now, you know, the term came into vogue after 9/11, chatter. And that's all this little bits and pieces of intelligence data that may not make a coherent, comprehensive picture. But once the incident takes place, then you can kind of fit it all together. Well, I think the Southern Poverty Law Center had made a valiant attempt to alert the federal government. And I think the federal government had paid attention to that alert. Now, Dees indicates that they had not. But I believe that the evidence that we present shows that there was an awareness in the U.S. government of a threat of bombings in Oklahoma, specifically in Oklahoma City or Tulsa, and that for whatever reason, that warning information proved insufficient for the government to prevent the bombing.
Obviously, too much information for us to go over all of these details here in this short conversation. So let's turn finally to Timothy McVeigh himself. Tell us a little bit about McVeigh and what you conclude about him, his motivations and his background.
Well, I'll play amateur psychiatrist for just a second. I think Timothy McVeigh was terribly traumatized by his mother's abandonment as he began his teenage years. He had a very difficult time adjusting to that. He was a bright kid, personable in high school, but he began to be attracted to what at the time was called the survivalist movement, where people wanted to have their own wherewithal to survive in case of some catastrophic collapse of the government or something. He also began to read a lot of Federalist papers and so on, began to question the size of government. He became committed to the belief that the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, is all that stands between the individual citizen ultimately and a overbearing and corrupt central government that could become tyrannical if it wasn't for the armed citizen that kept it from becoming tyrannical. McVeigh had some kind of nondescript jobs out of high school, joined the Army, loved the discipline, loved the association with weapons and machinery, and was a very, very good soldier, and we describe that. He's then sent to the U.S. war with Iraq in 1991, early 1991, and it's over in just a few days. But during those days, he is further traumatized by killing Iraqi soldiers, which he later thinks about and realizes, at least in his view, were just kind of guys like him, you know, doing the bidding of a big government that was so far removed from them and their interests, and they were just cogs in this huge machinery. He comes back to Fort Riley, Kansas in summer of 1991. goes to a special forces screening course at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He's not physically prepared for it because he's been riding an armored vehicle around the sands of Iraq for months, and his feet are not as tough as they would have been if he had been out doing conditioning hikes and so on as an infantryman. So he can't complete the screening course because his feet blister badly. But this is one of the things that most people are not aware of. He's invited to come back. McVeigh is not washed out. He's not bitter about that, or at least my belief he's not bitter about it. He's invited to come back when his feet are in condition. He decides to stay in the Army, but then after the experience with the failing the Special Forces screening course, decides, no, he wants out of the Army. He gets out the last of December 1991, begins kind of bumming around the country. But while he was in the Army, he had somehow gravitated toward a very dark and, I would have to say, distorted, evil view of race relations in general. He carried around...
Before we get into that issue, perhaps we can talk about the letter which he wrote to his sister Jennifer McVeigh on October 20th, 1993, which was republished in the New York Times on July 1st, 1998, in which he talked about his selection for to become part of a special cadre when he was at Fort Bragg, in which he said, quote, when he was talking about what they had told him this group was going to be involved in, he said, quote, "What I learned next, both from the briefings and from the questions and private talks, included, one, we would be helping the CIA fly drugs into the U.S. to fund many covert operations. Two, military consultants were to work hand in hand with civilian police agencies to quiet anyone who was deemed a security risk. We would be government-paid assassins, and three, many other details. To verify these last two, see the enclosed article or watch again this movie, Lethal Weapon." So he was talking about some very, very interesting parts of his supposed assignment there at Fort Bragg. Perhaps we can talk about that.
Well, you know, he did put that in the letter. He further, when he was on the death row at Terre Haute in Indiana from 1999 to 2001, and became associated with a guy named David Paul Hammer, gave David Paul Hammer basically the same story. The problem with black ops is, by their nature and by their definition, the information is almost impossible to obtain to confirm that that version's true.
But it is possible to determine that if a different version is false. And on that note, tell us about the absolutely startling footage that has been unearthed by Bill Bean.
I'm sorry?
The startling footage that Bill Bean unearthed of McVeigh in August of 1993.
Is that supposedly where he's at Grafton, North Dakota?
At Camp Grafton, the Army National Guard Explosives Demolition Training Facility, in August of 1993, 2 years after McVeigh supposedly was discharged.
I've seen the pictures. I do not see it as McVeigh. I don't think it's a match.
Did you talk to Bill Bean for the book?
I have not, no.
Would you be interested in doing so?
Absolutely, sure. Yeah, but it does not look like McVeigh. And let me just say, John Doe 1, the sketch, I don't think is Tim McVeigh either. And we make that point in the book, that claim that Tim McVeigh rented the Ryder truck on Monday the 17th, 2 days before the bombing, at Eldon Elliott's Ryder rental office in Junction City, Kansas. The FBI has provided no fingerprint proof. There's no forensic data that's Tim McVeigh. And in fact, if you look at the physical description, Tim McVeigh is not even a close match. And we cite a U.S. Secret Service entry in a official record of information that they were getting from the FBI saying that McVeigh is not a match for the physical description. So,
and of course, we also have the security footage that was the CCTV footage of the Ryder truck pulling up to the building, which the FBI now claims doesn't exist or they can't find it, but which the LA Times and others have reported on.
You've said it doesn't exist now because Jesse Trinidad has a number of legal actions in federal court in Salt Lake City on that issue. And what the FBI has said is we can't find it. because in other documents, in an earlier suit by a fellow named David Hoffman and his attorney Michael Johnston of Oklahoma City, who's done superb work, the FBI itemized the videotapes that they had at the time, and this is a number of years ago, including one that was kept in Washington, D.C., away from where the other trial evidence was. So Jesse Trinidude is continuing to fight this out in federal court, and there's a hearing in June where the government has to respond to some of the judge's questions, and hopefully we're within just another year or so of getting some resolution on that. But the whole issue of surveillance tapes, I think, is a very troubling one for the government, because the Secret Service timeline, for example, there are three different citations of information. And again, this information comes from the FBI. The Secret Service has a liaison team in the office in the command center. The FBI is running in Oklahoma City. And so this liaison team is reporting the information back to their Secret Service Operations Center in Washington, D.C., and we have a record of that information as it was logged in to the Operations Center in Washington, D.C., and there are three separate entries referring to surveillance tape and suspects, plural, in one case, seen in a surveillance tape exiting the Ryder truck. So you would think the government would have wanted to use that to prove Tim McVeigh and others unknown, but at least McVeigh was present at the bomb scene and getting out of the Ryder truck that blew up. But because there was somebody with him and the government wanted to contain the suspects to McVeigh, Nichols, and Fortier, the government treated that as radioactive information and have tried to bury it.
Unfortunately so. Well, there's so much other information that we could get into with the testimony of Jane Graham or the story of Carol Howe or the story of Terence Yakey and Hoppe Heidelberg and so many other people who have questioned the official government story in various ways and whose story intersects with the narrative of Oklahoma City, what the investigation missed and why it still matters. But let's just turn finally to a discussion of the statement that you made earlier, that you want people to basically draw their own conclusions. You've documented the facts here and people can go away and put them together as they see best. But given the type of inflammatory rhetoric about calling people paranoid anti-government activists, etc., and given that most of my audience would probably fall into that type of description, what can you say about why they should be interested in this book?
Well, I think what we have for the first time is a huge amount of new information that's never been revealed before. And I think that given the nature of the publication, of the publishing business, that having HarperCollins put out a book which raises serious questions about the completeness and the validity of the government investigation in a way that has not been done before, I think, in a number of years at least, in any kind of mainstream publication, whether a book, magazine, or electronic version. I think under the adage that better is the enemy of good enough, I do not think this is the final story. I think this is a chapter in what will be a continuing series of stories, whether they're in books or documentaries or whatever. We're not at the truth. This is not the whole truth. This is more an expose, I think, based on fact that we could document that the government's case is flawed and is basically a lie. And if people have expectations that we're going to be able to expose that in some, concrete document. One document says, here's the plan that the government had in place to blow up the building, and here's why they wanted to do it. We don't make that claim. I personally don't believe the government wanted the building to be blown up. I believe the government, through incompetence or negligence or some combination, failed to to prevent the bombing. And that once that happened, then they had to construct this flimsy story of just these two losers, these two loners, McVeigh and Nichols, and with Michael Fortier in the background, the distant background, and brought in really only to be a witness against McVeigh and Nichols, that's an important achievement. And some people will say it's left out a lot of things. There are a lot of various versions out there. We've tried to screen them carefully. But again, this is the first chapter. It is not the final chapter in the Oklahoma City bombing. And if people had higher expectations, I wish we could have met them, but we had to be reviewed by lawyers, and we had to be certain of our facts. What we have, I think, will stand up to scrutiny. Some of the information, I think the quotes you have there was in the prologue. I don't think it's in the text of the book itself, in the chapters. So
actually, that was in chapter 2.
Was that in chapter 2? Okay, my mistake. Okay, well, it's in chapter 2.
All right, well, how can people, what's the best way for people to get a copy of the book?
Well, I am a big believer in supporting the independent bookstores. If you want to spend a little more money and do that, I would encourage you to do that. If you want the cheaper or easier way, some combination of cheaper and easier, then you have two websites that are generally used, Amazon.com, and Barnes & Noble has a website. So you can do that, and particularly if you're overseas and want to get it, order it and have it shipped, that's probably the better way.
All right. Roger G. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Look, there's an English language bookstore. I would imagine there is in a place as big as Tokyo, but what their selection of books is and how quickly they get them, I don't know.
Well, they can certainly be ordered from bookstores here at any rate, even if they're not in stock. So Roger G. Charles, co-author with Andrew Gumbel of Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, James. Take care.